Buying and selling your house can be very difficult, but with the right realtor, it can make it a whole lot easier. And that's why Daniel McGrath from Watson Realty can be there for you. And if you mention the Average Joes, you will get 1-year home warranty if you're buying a house. And if you're selling, Daniel will do a pre-listing home inspection for you if you sign up with him to sell your home. Again, that's Daniel McGrath at Watson Realty. His Instagram is Daniel_sells_Florida, and his website is Daniel McGrath, WatsonRealtyCorp.com. Today on the Average Joe Movie Show, we talk Kevin Smith, and that's it.
Hello.
Hello, my name is Matt.
It's me.
It's who's you?
I'm Shane.
It's Shane. Hey, Zach, say hello to
Andrew as well.
Oh, Andrew's here. Zach, say hello.
Zach?
Zach? Zach?
Where is he?
Know where Zach is? What happened to Zach? What happened to Zach? Oh, yeah, that's what happened to Zach. He's not here. He was supposed to be here, but wasn't. So we're going to roast him for being a little douchebag pants today. So in 3, 2, 1, we'll call him a douchebag. 3, 2, 1, douche.
Douchebag, asshole, piece of shit.
What a fucking piece of shit he is. Hope he never fucking comes back on the show. He'll be here.
Chicken
on the,
blood.
Yeah, he'll be here on the next show. He started doing the comedy thing again, so he gets a pass for trying to sleep in. Yeah. All right. Kevin Smith, born August 2nd, 1970. 51 years old. Just 2 weeks ago, at least today on August 15th, it was 2 weeks ago. But
well, happy birthday to him. He looks about the same as he did with his Clerks 2 stuff.
Well, he's a lot skinnier. He had a heart attack.
Yeah, he's super skinny now.
Does a lot of hiking. He vegan, vegetarian, one of those things now.
You know, I'm a complete, like, novice amateur, like, when it comes to Kevin Smith. Like, I don't know shit about him, but I did not know he was Silent Bob. And then I looked that up, and I was like, oh, wait, that is Kevin Smith. Holy shit.
I know nothing.
I was like, that motherfucker was massive. Like, I was like, damn, like,
he was a big boy.
Big as fuck.
Yeah, man, it's really ingenious. He wrote himself into the script of all these movies. Basically says nothing. He's just there to react and be a guy leaning up against the wall in front of a convenience store, you know, whatever. But once in a while, eventually, at some point in the film, in the third act, final act, whatever, have some words of wisdom that are always very sound, more so than any other character in the whole film. Yeah, so he makes sure his lines count.
Yep. You know, when Kevin Smith was making the first Clerks, he was going to try to play Randall, and then he realized he couldn't act. So that's when he got he got the other guy to do it. And he's like, that's why he has all the best lines. But Kevin Smith is widely popular now. He does a lot. He does a lot of underground things that you wouldn't know. Like, he's done TV shows. He's done a lot of TV shows.
Yeah, that's most of his directorial stuff in recent years, I've noticed. I haven't seen any of that stuff, but he's been doing a lot of that.
Supergirl is a big one.
He did that?
Mm-hmm. He did a lot of episodes there. I think he did an episode of The Flash. And this show called Reaper. That was a cool little TV show where this kid got his parents sold his soul to the devil, and now he has to work for the devil for eternity. So it was a cool little thing.
So how do you go to, like, nationally broadcast television to, like, Zach and Mary make a porno?
Well, he made those first.
Yeah, he's probably just like, I got to get this stuff out of my system, and now I can do the family stuff.
Well, I mean, he went to film school in Canada with his producer, now best friend, Scott Mosier. And he dropped out because it was more theory than practical filmmaking. Uh-huh. And then he started working at the Quick Stop in Jersey. And he started collecting credit cards so he can make his film. And that's when you got Clerks 1. You know, he specifically made it in black and white because of color correction.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want to make it in color because it would have been way more expensive to do so.
Dude, it's stories like that that I love about film debuts and early independent films and stuff like that. Like, I like the mishaps that lead to you know, what made the film iconic. You know, he didn't want it to be in black and white. Well, I love the fact that it's in black and white. You know, he's got, like, the shutters are down the whole film. It's because they had to film at night, right? The store was open all day and it was closed overnight, so they would only have a short window to film the movie in the convenience store. And he wrote into the story that the shutters, he couldn't get the lock was jammed or whatever. So, and he even explains it to his girlfriend, the lead character Dante explains it to his girlfriend in the movie why the shutters are still down, and they actually have to hang a sign saying that they're open. Otherwise, you would see out the windows that it was nighttime, clearly.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And that's another reason black and white just works.
Yeah. So, oh, yeah. And he pays homage to it in Clerks 2, and he pays homage to it in the reboot and all that. And
He plays definite homage to it in Zach and Mary Make a Porno, because they work, and then they film at night. So
yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
And then, you know, after he made Clerks 1, which became widely successful, he made Clerks 1 for $26,000, I'm sorry. He got a nice chunk of change to make Mallrats. And during the first weekend, they're like, it bombed. It was awful. Like, it was in maybe, I think they said 40, it was like 200 screens. It wasn't that many.
What do you think is, like, the reason for it? Do you think it was like it didn't have that charm, that small town vibe that Clerks 1 had, or
I'm not sure. Oh, my dog!
Probably just budget. You know, like $23,000 budget with Clerks, and it was so inventive and so creative for the time. Like, it's a little easier to be successful with that kind of budget, you know, versus, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I'm sure the Mallrats was closer to a million or in the, you know, low millions or something like that. It was probably just like strictly a budget thing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Clerks was made for, it says here, like 27.9 something. And it grossed 3.8 million. 27,000.
That's it? Oh. Yeah. Yeah. What, Clerks, you said? I thought we were talking Mallrats.
Clerks, right. Mallrats was a $6 million budget.
$6 million.
Okay. $6 million. So that's crazy. What it is. Like, you go from like $27 million and they're like, hey, we need you to manage a $6 million budget. Like, that just doesn't seem.
I don't think it was the content or the fact that it wasn't suited to like what was going on with the time. I don't know what it is. It doesn't make sense to me that Mallrats bombed, man.
Yeah.
All-star cast. Stan Lee was in it.
He was making cameos before.
Yeah.
You know what's crazy is that, you ever seen Captain Marvel?
No.
You see that one?
No.
Well, the cameo that he did in Captain Marvel, because it was set in the 90s, was Stan Lee reading the script to Mallrats, because he was auditioning to be in it. Like, he was in auditioning, he was just going to be in it. And that was the cameo that he was doing.
That's crazy.
He must really like that movie.
Yeah,
to include it in that.
Well,
maybe
he wasn't really included in a lot of movies in the 90s.
Yeah.
So it wasn't until way later that he became incredibly popular. And because knowing comics in the 90s was a fucking nerd thing to do. It wasn't the thing to do to do now, like comic book movies and knowing all the lore.
It's still a nerd thing. It's just being a nerd has become more socially acceptable. Yeah. I think.
Yeah,
it's not really an insult anymore. Like, if you're a nerd, it usually means you're smart. Like,
you know your shit. Official 6.1 million, 2.1 box office.
Jesus. So it had a smaller box office than Clerks 1 in, I mean, what is that, 30 times the budget?
Yeah. Well, they definitely made their money back from VHS.
Yeah.
When he made Mallrats. But there was Ben Affleck was in Mallrats. So ABC picked it up right after Good Will Hunting, if I want to say. It might have been Phantoms. And ABC wanted to do a Ben Affleck double feature. And so they had to edit the movie. They had to edit the movie to have sound bites over the cuss words. And Jason Mewes, who is a heavy pill and heroin addict at the time, was supposed to be recording. And he never showed up the four times that it was scheduled. And so the assistant that worked for the company had to do it. And so every time that you hear the TV version, which is on the Arrow version, Arrow Blu-ray version that is released now, you'll hear the awful Jay impersonation first censored, like for the fly fat ass fly. He is like, "Fly, Batman, fly." And it was like in my voice. It wasn't in his, it wasn't even close. Also, speaking of Jason Mewes, he had to audition to be Jay in Mallrats. The studio was like, "Yeah, we're going to get somebody more popular." And they wanted to put in Seth Green.
Oh.
Seth Green. And so.
It's a no for me, dog.
So you hear fucking, you hear Jason Mewes just go, he's like about to audition. He's going snitchy, in his own role. What the fuck is going on here? But they obviously kept with him. And then, like any director who bombs, they want to probably blow their head off or anything like that. So he goes underground, back, and makes Chasing Amy for $600,000. His producer didn't like that. Scott Mosier was like, "How much money did you say we got? $600,000, bro. I told him I could make it for it." He was like, because that's not a lot to make a movie then. So did you like Chasing Amy?
Yeah, I love Chasing Amy.
Yeah?
Yeah, this week I watched almost everything. I think short of Jersey Girl, which I didn't have a whole lot of interest in. I might watch it at some point. I didn't watch Cop Out. I forgot about that one. And I'm never going to watch Yoga Hosers because it looks fucking stupid to me. But I watched every other major Kevin Smith film in the last 2 weeks. And Chasing Amy was one of a couple that I had never seen. I don't know why, man, because I loved it. Allie enjoyed it. We both watched it. And I think I liked it quite a bit more than her. It just had everything that I love in a film.
Yeah,
it was great. It was a great story. I'm a sucker for an offbeat romance, you know.
You're like, gonna have to fuck my girlfriend.
Dude, I didn't expect that at all. I thought he was fucking with him, honestly. I can't believe his character's a douchebag, man. Yeah. His character's an asshole. In the end, I was like, Holden fucking sucks.
Yeah,
man. You know?
Just like Spanky? What was this? What was the other
Banksy.
Banky? Banksy? I don't know. Fuck.
Banksy.
Spanky. Well, Jesus.
Yeah. That's Jason Lee's character.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, I corrected. Budget was $250,000. That's why.
Oh, wow. Really low.
Yeah. So, but the box office was $12 million.
That's crazy. Like, it seems like the lower the budget, the better the box office for his release.
Yeah,
like, I'm sure Cop Out was ridiculous.
It is kind of a no-frills movie, you know? There wasn't anything, there were no spectacles, there wasn't anything that should have been super costly. It was a lot of that was probably paying the actors and shit, you know? Because there were some decent actors in it, including, obviously, Ben Affleck in the leading role. At that point, he had already really established himself, but he's a friend of Kevin Smith's, so he always seems to show up in one form or another, even if it's just a tiny cameo. But, yeah, that's a... For more mainstream audiences, kind of getting away a little bit, it still had Kevin Smith's comedy throughout, like, for sure. But it didn't go off the wall like a lot of his other films go, a lot of his comedies. It wasn't super over the top. It was more mainstream, more approachable. So I understand why it was more of a success. Also, audiences love offbeat romance. I'm not the only one that likes that sort of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it. I always wanted the shirt, the lesbian, the roads to, it was like the Easter Bunny, Santa Claus, and a lesbian and a dyke.
Oh, yeah.
And I was just like, you see what the difference is between these three and this one? Is there a fucking figment of your imagination? Or something like that. I was just like, damn. Well, after that, we're going to go through everything, it seems like, he made his... sort of religious movie.
Most controversial movie he's ever made.
Yeah. In Dogma. You ever seen that, Chain? Do you ever see that one?
No, but I'm looking at it right now, and I'm trying to see. Because I've...
Another great cast. Ben Affleck.
Janine Garofalo.
You got
Alanis Morissette.
Alan Rickman. Yeah, Alanis Morissette plays God.
George Carlin.
George Carlin. Fuck yeah.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen it.
Salma Hayek.
Yeah, that's right. Chris Rock.
Matt
Chris
Damon, Rock, of course. Yeah. Huge all-star cast. That was one of the first I ever saw. And it's still after Clerks. I'm a sucker. I got a soft spot in my heart for a directorial debut. I love Clerks. Love everything about it. I think it's flawless. Number two would be Dogma for sure.
Close race or just like
no?
Clerks one's well above.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. But yeah, I love all the controversy that surrounds Dogma. You know, like in this day and age, there's. You know, it's everything's so much more politically correct than it was at the time. There's stuff you probably couldn't get away with. Maybe there's stuff you could get away with even more so now. You know, it's the times have changed. But people really didn't appreciate his unique take on certain religious aspects throughout the film.
He made signs. He
protested his own film, right?
He was like, they were...
As a publicity stunt. Everybody was protesting it, literally picketing it with signs and stuff. And he showed up at his own protest and protested it.
Yeah, and he got on camera. And he's like, yeah, we're just here to support, you know.
It's like, come on, people. There's a fucking full-on novel of a disclaimer at the beginning of the film. When the film starts off, it just explains how this is all comedy. Like, not to be taken seriously. This is lore. This is fiction. This is for fun. And everybody gets fucking...
Just in an uproar. Yeah. Like, I don't care. It's usually when somebody says the name.
Those people shouldn't have watched it.
Yeah.
They just don't watch it. You go into a film that's like a unique comedic tongue-in-cheek, you know, just a weird take on different religions. And if you think that's the kind of thing that's going to be controversial, it's going to upset you, why would you even watch it, man?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like it's I don't get it. You know?
Does it contain like the same type of humor as like Clerks?
Clerks, it's so funny.
Definitely. I mean, it's got... You know.
But it's, like, really grown up. Like, it's really mature.
It's got Jay and Silent Bob in it. All these films have Jay and Silent Bob in them for the most part. So it's even got some of the same characters, you know?
He's like, do you do anal? Is it true if bitches fart when you blast them in the ass? Jesus. Which one are you guys going to do me first, huh? You know,
it's just fun, dude. It's a battle between angels and... demons, and Jason Lee is a demon sent from hell, and
there's a shit
Chris
demon?
Rock is an angel. Alanis Morissette plays God, so they make God a female right there. You know people are gonna get pissed off. Mm-hmm. Why?
It's just like
it's a fucking movie. Like
saying Jesus is black.
No. This is a big middle finger to.
Yeah, they do the buddy Jesus thing, and
yeah,
but yeah, similar humor, just. Really had some fun with it, man. Mm-hmm. Just took it into fantasy territory. There's a shit monster that's all like prosthetic effects.
I feel like I've seen
legit
part of this
shit monster
movie.
That just shoots shit at them in a bar, attacks them in a bar.
Yeah, I got to send it to Goldgofflin.
Yeah,
Goldgofflin. What? Oh, you masturbate more than anyone on the planet. Shit, everybody knows that. When you're doing it, you're thinking about guys.
Yeah. And then Ben Affleck and Matt Damon they're fallen angels.
Yeah.
Matt Damon plays Loki. So they're not in God's graces anymore because they had a problem with like God requiring them to do too much destruction, like from the plagues and like stuff like that, you know? So they branch away from God. And do their own thing, kind of. And Matt Damon is just like ready to fucking kill anybody for any reason if they're blasphemous. Like literally, he holds a gun to a lady's head because she didn't say "God bless you" when he sneezed. Like he murders an entire room full of people, and she was the one. Ben Affleck, he knows whether or not you're like blasphemous right off the bat. He can walk up and know he's an angel, and she's the one that's innocent. And Matt Damon's gonna holds a gun to her head. You didn't say "God bless you" when I sneeze, and he almost kills her.
Yeah.
So that's a really controversial take on some angels sent from heaven. Uh-huh. Well, fallen angels—they're not allowed in heaven anymore. They're trying to get back into heaven. They want to go home. Yeah. It's... Alan Rickman is an angel. Angels don't have private parts in the movie. Like, he literally pulls down his pants and he's a Ken doll. Yeah, just stuff
I
like that, man.
It was... If I wanted to, angels are ill-equipped.
It was so creative.
I don't know what happened.
I'd like to see Kevin Smith do more stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll get into that in a little bit because he does a major shift soon. So now he brings this entire View Askew. That's what he named his production company, View Askew, and I call it the View Askewniverse because everybody plays a role in it.
Uh-huh.
And Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back is like that. I wouldn't call it like Endgame, but it's like the Avengers of his world, and where Jay and Silent Bob are the main focus now because they got to go to Hollywood because somebody's making a movie about them based on them, which was from Chasing Amy.
Mm-hmm.
But they sit at the Quick Stop from Clerks 1. I think the only thing really that's not interpreted in this, which may be, Dogma. Yeah, Dogma wasn't really...
I don't think they really tied it in. They made Ben Affleck at times, you know, when they're filming the movies, they're doing Good Will Hunting 2 just as a joke. But then they also make Ben Affleck Holden, his character from Chasing Amy. So certain characters play multiple characters within the same film in certain movies. So he's just, that's what makes it a universe. He's constant, especially Jason Lee. He's got a few.
Yeah.
He plays a couple characters within the same film sometimes, you know.
Chris Rock plays a director in it.
Oh, yeah. But they definitely don't tie in Dogma from what I remember in that.
But they definitely satire the entire movie industry, and it's so funny.
How many directors do that to where they like get their friends and like they have a universe of the same people doing the same kind of roles?
That was a topic of discussion that we were going to do. They might as well do it now.
I don't think that happens a lot.
Yeah, that's pretty cool that he does it like that.
Yeah. Hey man, he was doing the MCU before the MCU existed, bro.
Yeah.
like you want to talk about cinematic universes? Like I can't remember anybody else. Like everybody else just made sequels.
Yeah.
You know, he actually truly morphed them into one, and that was so clever of him. And like in the 90s, because we're now in the 2000s with Kevin Smith, like from that just that filmography itself, you know, like I contemplated who was the better writer at that point between Quentin Tarantino and Kevin Smith, because that was
Get Out,
you know.
You got to go. You got
to
leave.
Yeah, it's time to leave.
I don't want to shit on Kevin Smith within Kevin Smith's, you know, within this podcast, but it's Tarantino. That's a no-brainer. I mean, Kevin Smith created the better cinematic universe. Tarantino kind of dabbles a little bit in cinematic universe here and there. He hasn't created anything substantial in that respect, but I think he's the better writer. Kevin Smith created the better universe.
But would you think so? Like best dialogue writer, when you hear a lot of the cool points that he would make, just look at Dogma in its whole. Like he created that entire thing. Like he didn't. It's not like he stole it from another movie.
Yeah,
you know, like no. Or
are you talking about originality?
Yeah, his originality was way. I'm not talking about, you know, Pulp Fiction, because that's obviously that changed the way the movies are made. But like his dialogue in general. Like
he's a great writer. It just feels a little cheaper to me, and like more, I don't like less diegetic, like less realistic. Mm-hmm. You know, Tarantino has a way of like creating conversations that are interesting, but also really mundane.
Mm-hmm.
That would kind of relate to that. Everybody can just sit there and just like zone out. Like you're literally listening to a real conversation. You know, it doesn't have anything to do with the topic. It's not super over the top. It just feels mundane and realistic, you know, but also interesting.
Yeah.
You don't think Kevin Smith can do that?
He can do it, but not without the jokes and the over the topness and the, it just doesn't feel, his conversations don't feel quite as realistic to me, if that makes sense. In a good way. That's what I want out of his movies.
Right.
You don't want realism out of a Kevin Smith movie, so he's doing what he should be doing. I guess maybe it's a matter of preference on that form of writing.
What about range, too? Because I know, you know, Quentin Tarantino's got a lot of, all his stuff's basically action, but it's got humor, whereas Kevin Smith is kind of just comedy.
You know, well,
It's Once not we, just it, comedy. Yeah. He does drama really well. And Chasing Amy, that movie's fucking heavy duty, man. Like, I didn't see Jersey Girl, like I said, but Chasing Amy is, it's not a comedy forward film. It's more of a drama. It's a heavy story, man. It's really well written.
All of them are.
Just like, for the most part, he does comedy.
There's a lot of depth. And once, and then now, you know, we're going to be getting to Clerks 2 in a moment. You know, like, he'll tie it in. He's a very good, and this is where I think Quentin Tarantino is lacking in story arcs. The arcs of stories get blatantly cut off because he kills them.
Yeah, well, also, it's the nonlinear aspect of it. It's tough to create a naturally occurring story arc when by the time you get there, you're just jumping back to what happened at the beginning of the movie, and you're all over the fucking place. Because he has such a weird format with his writing, you know?
It's just I've never seen, like maybe, I don't know, like, he always leaves his story arcs unfinished, which is fine. Nothing's really changed about the character. You know, besides, like, his revenge plots, he gets his revenge, or she gets her revenge. Like, that's fine, but nothing in between is, like, changed. I don't know, like, she's
just... Like, there's no, like, hero's journey kind of thing.
Yeah, and there's not, like, a change of mind. Like, it's always dead set, like, Kill Bill. Like, at the end, you're going to kill Bill. Like, it's not like, hey, maybe I won't kill you.
Yeah, so less conventional format, which in the... If you think about it in broad terms, it's just less pleasing to audiences in a way. It does, you don't get that. You never get that feel good moment in a Tarantino movie, other than when somebody's getting their revenge or whatever. It's not like everything sums up to the final conclusion where finally what you wanted to happen happens. Yeah. Now, you don't know what the fuck's going to happen, and what you think's going to happen is not what's going to happen in a Tarantino film. You know?
I disagree though with that, because at the end of Kill Bill, like when they're talking, she has like that kind of resolution with Bill, and it's like, I kind of don't want to kill him, and then he comes after her, and then she does the thing.
No, that's not how it ended. He's like, you and I have unfinished business.
Yeah, and then he pulls his sword out, and then she does the five-point palm thing, and he walks and dies.
Well, she definitely wasn't contemplating not killing him.
Yeah, but she didn't come after him, though. Like, she was listening to him talk about her daughter and all that.
Well, yeah, I mean that was a great plot point, but, you know, that's just
she didn't have, like, a change of heart. But the way it went down wasn't like she just went in there and started slashing at him or anything. Yeah. It kind of just was like, all right, let's.
I don't know. I think character development is more on Kevin Smith's side than, like, building tension and building dramatic moments is Quentin Tarantino, and that's great. I guess you know, maybe it's like apples and oranges in that regard, but it just seems like when I'm watching Clerks 1, not a lot happens, you know. Like, hey man, this job would be great if it wasn't for all the fucking customers, you know.
I looked at Allie, we just watched that. I was like, yeah, that's my exact outlook at work all the time. You don't even know how much I can relate to that.
Yeah, there's a lot of relatable things, like even in Dogma, that's how people feel about religion most of the time. Like, they think it's a fucking joke.
Clerks 1 is so human. Like, that's what I love about that movie. It just feels so like, it feels so real. Like, it feels like just a daily monotony type movie.
We can relate on a personal basis, dude. Yeah. I worked at Video Time, where Zach worked and then eventually owned for a time. We would hang out there before I ever worked there. We'd hang out there all day, every day, you know? And it felt a lot like that, man. It was like that little shopping center. There was, like, right next door, there's a pizza place. And we were never in the video store, and the owner of the pizza place was never in the pizza place. We're always, like, outside, like, bullshit and stuff. Yeah. I knew the people at the Hardee's. I knew the people in the Save-A-Lot. Like, we all just, like, kind of knew one another, and that movie, from the first time I ever saw it, felt really relatable because of that experience. Mm-hmm. I had that experience before I ever saw Clerks, you know?
Yep. And Quentin Tarantino movies definitely don't have that.
Yeah, like,
they're larger than life.
They're not real world at all. They don't feel relatable. They feel...
They feel like a spectacle most of the time.
Yeah, for sure.
It's like, these people are crazy.
Yeah. Like, he's comic, they feel like Pulp Fiction. Yeah. You know, they feel more like one of the just the exploitation from the 60s and 70s. Yep. You know that's where his influences lie. He loved the over-the-top, crazy storylines and characters.
Whenever somebody asks me about, like, you know, the change in the 90s, like, you know, everybody talks about Quentin Tarantino, and I'm just like, man, you know, I feel like Kevin Smith doesn't get his due, you know, because he ruled the independent world in the 90s. You know, there was, and then the, you know, everybody had their big spectacle movies, but Kevin Smith was still making quality films, you know. Like Quentin Tarantino made Jackie Brown, which I love, but that's like
really not just independent, I wouldn't consider. Yeah. I wouldn't consider Pulp Fiction. He just didn't stay independent long.
Yeah.
Because he started right out of the gate with something. Well, he obviously had a much bigger budget for Reservoir Dogs, you know, just the cast alone. Like, what did he make before that? My Best Friend's Wedding or something. I've never seen that, you know. I don't know why. His career just kind of took off like a slingshot, where Kevin Smith's kind of teeter-tottered back and forth, and he had to really work for it, you know. He started off more core independent in my, you know.
So I was just, I wanted to know your opinions, which were all valid. I can't disagree with them. But so after Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, you know, his whole Avengers universe, which he actually made for $20 million, and he had a lot of fun with doing all that. He added so many. Wes Craven was in the movie. And it was like, it was just him counting his money. It was like, it's not what the kids want. He counts his money.
Yeah, he got everybody, dude. He got Carrie Fisher. He got
Mark Hamill.
Yeah, Mark Hamill was in it. He played a big part. He played Cock Knocker. they're filming the Blunt Man and Chronic, which is the comic within a movie. A movie within a movie. Amy. Yeah, it originated. They were comic book artists in Chasing Amy. They created it, so they tied that in. And Mark Hamill plays like a fucking dildo looking lightsaber battle, basically, like that. They even make the comment, oh, we're definitely getting sued for this, or something along those lines. Yep. Like, George Lucas isn't going to like this. but that was one thing I don't think we've mentioned yet, was that Kevin Smith is a fucking Star Wars junkie, man. Like, you can't get through a single film. You normally can't get 10 minutes into a film without there being a Star Wars conversation.
Uh-huh. Clerks 1. Would you like more Return or
Empire.
Yeah, Empire. And then he said,
I love their, dude, I fucking love that conversation so much.
Yeah.
It's such a nerd conversation. They get into blasphemy. They get into genuine logistics and like real world stuff, like involving Star Wars, like that to blow up the Death Star the first time was, you know, less of a fucked up thing because it was all like troopers and stuff, you know, whatever. But the second time, the Death Star hadn't been fully constructed yet. So, you know, they don't know how to build a Death Star. They got private contractors in there doing fucking beams, doing the roofing, doing this and that. And he's like, think about how many private contractors, how many innocents had to die to blow up that second Death Star. You got to think of it like that's such a, I think he had to have sat down and been like, or he probably just had that idea. He's so creative. But he was like, what's a conversation that nobody's ever had about Star Wars?
You know? Like, damn, it doesn't involve
the lore.
Like, that's the thing. I'm like, man.
Hey, that's a good point.
That's kind of like how I feel about, you know, going back to his writing. I was like, it makes you realize some things. Like, wow, that I have never thought about that before. And it's right in front of my fucking face.
It's something only a nerd would think of.
Yeah. And janitors and stuff in there.
Yeah.
In Mallrats, they talk about who can, you know, Lois Lane can't handle Superman's sperm. You know, only Wonder Woman can. You know, stuff like that. You know, but that would kill her.
People get like that. They're like Jason Lee, and once he runs into Stan Lee in Mallrats, he has to know fucking everything. He's like little underground questions that are between the lines that you would never directly know from a comic. He starts asking that stuff, like the Thing. Does he have a fucking giant rock dick? Like, you know, he has to. You know, and
he asks all the sexually driven questions.
That, if you're a true like dedicated comic book nerd, you do wonder stuff like that. You know.
and you know, not only that, his vocabulary is incredible.
Yeah.
She called you callow. She'd say that like it's bad. It means frightened and weak-willed. I thought that was the only part of the thing that was complimentary. Now back to our timeline here, man. It's God. We're not like we're still in the Viewisk universe. This is where a lot of things tie together. This is when I started actually becoming a fan, is when Clerks 2 came out. But I did see, I will tell you this one story. I made my mom buy the pay-per-view of Jay and Silent Bob. I was like, that looked good. Bam! And the first
fuck, motherfuck,
my mom turned it off immediately. She's like, thank you for wasting $20.
It's Jay and Silent Bob in front of the quick stop. Their mom's dropping them off outside against the wall they always stand on while they go inside to do their shit. And his mom's just cussing left and right, a lot of fucks. And then Jay, as a child, says, fuck. Fuck! And then it transitions into them as adults. It's still in front of the quick stop. It's great. Yeah. It is one of my favorite moments ever in that universe.
Yeah. So it's, dude, I think I just filled the cup.
I'm kind of surprised. I've actually seen Mallrats and Jay and Silent Bob.
There you go. See?
I was like, hold on. I've seen this.
That's why I mentioned when you said earlier, you hadn't seen. I was like, Jay and Silent Bob was the first one I saw. And I feel like it's a lot of people's first because it was like, it was the most mainstream I think that he had ever really made.
Yeah. That was like
revolving around those characters.
I remember seeing posters everywhere for it when I was younger. I was like, huh, that looked pretty cool. Like in the malls and stuff like that. Uh-huh. But yeah, now he makes Clerks 2. He goes back and actually makes his first sequel, true sequel. And this time it's 10 years later. And this one is – that one I like more at the moment because I'm 30 now. Mm-hmm. And I'm – you know, not mid-30s.
Which they are in the film. Dante's like 33 or something. And that's a big concept that keeps coming up regularly is how they're aging and they feel like they're...
the world has left them behind.
Yeah, exactly.
The world's not in front of them anymore. Yeah. And that's like, it's fucking true, man. Like, it was really something that I never really thought about when I was watching Clerks 2. I mean, the emotion hit me like, because that's how it was. But now I watched the movie just a couple of weeks ago, and I was just like, holy shit, man. You know, like...
Hit home?
Yeah.
I think it's a perfect blend. I would say, you know, some. I was like, all of his films are more comedy-driven. Chasing Amy's more drama. I think it's a good 50-50, you know, because of that, because they're all dealing with those concepts. Uh-huh. And it's obviously relationships and everything really come into play. The relationship between Dante and Randall.
And man and donkey.
Yeah. it becomes very dramatic, you know, as far as, you know, where their friendship lies and where they're going in life and whatever. And I think it's, I would almost say maybe 60-40. It feels more drama than comedy to me in a way that I like, in a way I appreciate. I like that level of his writing.
Yeah, he definitely knew the line not to cross it.
Yeah,
but you know, there's some points where you just go, okay. The Transformers were a total slight against God. Jesus, God sent His only begotten Son, die on a cross for the sins of humanity, and all we had to do to pay Him is make horrible fucking cartoons like the Transformers.
That's what made me realize how long ago that film came out.
16 years ago.
Yeah, the one dude was like, they're making a live-action Transformers movie. I was like, what? That hadn't even come out yet?
Yeah.
Holy shit. I worked at the movie theater at the time that Transformers came out.
Pickle Fucker. The Donkey Show. Rosario Dawson was awesome. You know, there. You know, and he's currently making Clerks 3 right now. And I wonder what it's going to be like, but we'll get to that.
It's going to be in your 50s with kids.
Yeah, he's 50. He's 51 now.
I wonder what they're going to do, because Clerks 2, at the beginning, the quick stop burned down. So they're working at Movies the whole time. This motherfucker, by the way, had a Movies – Matt had a Movies shirt all through high school. Always wore that thing, man. The purple – purple and yellow iconic looking Movies shirt, which is just a fast food joint that Randall and Dante both end up working at because the video store burns down. So I'm not sure exactly what the plot setup is going to be, where they're going to be working. They're rebuilding it. So it's just going to be back to normal. RST Video, is that going to be a part of it?
From what I've seen already, this is we're already talking about it. It's a CBD oil. Dispensary. And as of right now, I don't know what plot it's going to be, but I hope it's Lionsgate took it over instead of that Legion. Legion sucks. I like their films, but they you know, Kevin Smith is just like, you know, when he made Jane Silent Bob reboot, I was just like, we'll get to that one.
Well, I've always had a lot of respect for Lionsgate.
Yeah.
A lot of creative freedom allotted. A lot of my favorite films, like when the origins of Lionsgate, when I first started seeing them, I think certain, especially horror films, wouldn't exist without them. You know, they'd be a very different film with more, you know, production company influence and stuff. I think they've always allowed a lot of creative freedom and really kickstarted a lot of independent filmmakers that I know and love today. So I think that's going to be a good thing for sure. I wonder why it's not going to be the quick stop, though, when the Clerks 2 ends with them rebuilding the place.
I'm sure there's going to be time that passes. Yeah. So we'll see. But the RST video is the CBD oil. I'm sure the convenience store is going to be there.
Yeah.
You know, we'll see.
It's going to be great because you're going to have like random ass people coming out of there, going into the gas station, getting food and shit, just saying like high stuff.
Well, no Back brainer. Here's why RST video doesn't exist. Because video stores don't exist.
Yeah, right.
Obviously, like I didn't even think about that. It's like I would love to think that within the Viewisk universe, like video stores still exist. But no, we need to be a little more realistic and modern than that. Yeah. There are no video stores. I know that because I worked at the last surviving video store in this town, you know.
Yeah.
So that could be cool, though.
Yeah. And then, you know, now we make Clerks 2, and then he leaves. He's done with the Viewisk name. Scott Mosier wanted to leave. David Klein went in, you know, who's their director of photography, went and he's actually a pretty famous photographer now. Scott Mosier wanted to take a break, and Kevin Smith just kind of wanted to take a break from those characters as well and wanted to make something different. And that's when he made Jersey Girl. And that got shitted on pretty heavily. And after that, he kind of contemplated, you know, just leaving completely, you know, and he was told by, you know, the studio heads, like, movies aren't being around hanging out with friends, all right? And he's like, that's exactly the movie I want to make. And then he goes back to Miramax. Well, I think Miramax did do Jersey Girl, but Miramax greenlights the film based on one title, Zack and Miri Make a Porno. And then he makes that one. You know, I know he's totally skipped over Jersey Girl.
Let's skip over Jersey Girl.
It's definitely a blemish on his filmography, that and a couple others. But there's a couple. This is that transition where I think he had an identity crisis, and he hadn't really recovered, honestly, since. Because Zack and Miri Make a Porno was really good. Honestly, it was traditional Kevin Smith. All new characters. Seth Rogen was on the rise, or had risen to his kind of top of the fame.
I'll make a bold statement. I think it's his funniest film.
I agree. I love that movie.
To me, it's the funniest.
Shut your mouth or I'm going to fuck it.
No, Superbad is, but, you know.
No, I mean, just Kevin Smith. Written by Kevin Smith. Like, the dialogue, just in general, that movie's funnier to me than anything else that he's written.
Yeah, it's... I want Kevin Smith and Seth Rogen to do another movie together really bad. Because Seth Rogen, he writes really good jokes.
Seth Rogen, when he was talking to his agent, and he's like, what are your goals? He's like, I want to be in a Kevin Smith movie. Like, that was his dream, to be in a Kevin Smith movie. And they offered him the role.
He fit right in. He belonged.
Yeah.
You know?
It sucks that it was kind of the only movie they did together. You know, he was doing a bunch of other things too. He's doing a lot of TV work. And this was when he started his podcast as well, Smodcast, with him and Scott Mosier. And they just talked about movies and talked about, that was the beginning of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So they had a lot of things going with that. And he was an incredibly smart guy and knew exactly. He not to say he mapped out everything, like, but he's a very emotional dude. Like, when YouTube came out, and he would review, like, I think he reviewed Infinity War and Endgame. He reviewed Endgame after having his heart attack, and he was just in tears while describing it. Like, he was just like, because it was his entire childhood coming on the big screen. Like, that's what you see in. It just, like, he'll cry at trailers. He'll cry at he's very heavy, like, emotionally heavy dude.
I think he's always been, but I think more so, since he had the heart attack. I saw it, like, in the reboot. Like, I see it in his roles. It's like he's seeing life with a fresh perspective, mm-hmm. because he was like so close to dying. Like, you start questioning your own mortality and start realizing what truly, where your values truly lie in life. Yeah. And I think he's gone through, obviously you see it in his social media, you know, with mm-hmm. how healthy he's being with veganism and hiking and everything, but just, you even see it like in his performances and just the way that he views life now and in his writing, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it doesn't hit for me nowadays. I keep on saying we'll get to that.
Zach and Miri does it?
Well, Zach and Miri does it because, you had Craig Robinson, you know, when they were done editing the movie, and they're like, you know, we got all this stuff right here, and, you know, then we got this boring-ass shit. What the fuck are we going to do with this?
Yeah.
You know, like.
Yeah, that was another one. It was a good blend of sentimentality and...
her name, Bubbles.
And comedy. You know, there was a lot of sentimentalism in it. It was an offbeat romance with a just brilliant, brilliant comedy written into it. It's one of his most mainstream films, I would say, as far as the formatting goes and everything. Uh-huh. And it's just, to me, it's just damn near flawless. It's awesome.
I saw that in Port Orange 6. I thought it was one of the last movies I saw in there.
Yeah.
Was Zachary Mary McFarland. There was one other guy in there, and he left.
It's pretty explicit, man.
It's bad.
It is. It's pretty brutal. Bad. You see Jason Mewes' asshole. Like, you know, like.
I had to sneak to watch
fucking
that
movie. Full
frontals,
like a girl getting anal, and when he pulls out, somebody gets their face shitted on because of the camera angle he was trying to get. Like, I mean, it is. He did not hold back.
It's so bad.
It was his most explicit, probably, screenplay ever.
I saw porno when I was like 12, and I was damn, I gotta watch this shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
That's part of why it was so funny. It was so raunchy. There was like no holds barred, man. Anything goes. There was nothing that he like held back on.
Yep.
I like that. I don't like the idea of a director having to hold back because of a production company.
Then he started making TV.
Yeah. Or Society.
Well, then he made a movie, you know, after Zach and Miri. You know, and this actually put the, you know, before we go, Zach and Miri with Justin Long. Like, Justin Long was making, you know, he was kind of in the zone at that point. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of wondering where he, you know, where he kind of was, because he did Jeepers Creepers early. That was one of his first roles. And then he made, he was in this movie Accepted, which was also, he was that kind of ditzy, comedy guy. He was a slapstick most of the time. And
like
then,
a Jason Biggs type.
Yeah. Guy. And then what was the other film that he was in? Dodgeball. He was in Dodgeball as well. Like, he was just like that. And he was in, I don't know if that was made, Drag Me to Hell. So he was kind of like all over the place. And his defining role, I think, is his role in Zach and Mary Make a Porno with the
gay
guy,
sure,
you know, and
he's fucking hilarious. Brandon, I think.
Yeah.
Oh my God, man. The second he popped up on screen, we just watched it like two nights ago. That was one of the last ones I watched. All I had to do was see his face standing on the, like, on the edge of the room, like outside of the crowd, fucking just staring at the crowd. All I did was see his face, and I just busted out laughing, dude. Automatically. He hadn't even said or done anything yet, and I was laughing hard already.
Dude, I love it so much. It's like, so you're in the movies? So you're in fucking movies. He goes, fucking movies.
Fucking movies. The voice, the fake voice he does is perfect, dude.
Yeah. You like Glengarry Glenn Ross type all male cast? More like I can't do it on a straight face. I don't mean to be out of line, but are you in gay porn? Guilty as charged. So after he makes this awesome movie, he makes a nice terrible movie, and this is again that identity crisis is still kind of there, and he makes Cop Out, which he didn't write. It was one of the films that he didn't write.
I guess I didn't realize that's considered a terrible movie. You know, I don't think I ever saw. I only saw bits and pieces. I was at the movie theater when it came out, but I didn't realize that was considered like not one of his best.
Well, the biggest part about it was is that he didn't write it.
Yeah,
and So it was just like, I'm sure he did a lot of things to the script, but it was definitely not a Kevin Smith feel.
He's a writer first and a director second.
Yeah, kind of thing. And that's really all I'm going to say about that. Yeah. He does not like Bruce Willis. Bruce Willis is a fucking dickhead. That's what he claims, and they won't work together.
Damn, that sucks.
I can see that.
That's a bummer.
Yeah.
But then again, I don't know, because...
At that point in your career, you're working with Bruce Willis. He probably...
Nobody liked him.
Well, Bruce Willis probably considered himself better than the project.
Yeah.
Like, he was doing a fucking charity case. Like, yeah. You know, it's like, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, that's... Damn.
That sucks. I'm kind of... They kind of bummed me out a little bit.
I know.
I actually do like Bruce Willis.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, I like still Red. Like his acting, but I'm not gonna hang out with the guy.
Yeah.
No, but
fuck, I was gonna hang out with him, dude.
Dude, I was gonna hang out with him next week. Sucks. Bro.
Cancel that 10 o'clock.
So now he goes again underground, and he makes a horror movie about another one about religion, and it's called Red State. And I'm gonna be honest with you, this is a 180 from what he's done, and he's written this movie as well, and it's about the what are they called, the Westboro Baptist Church.
Yeah.
And they're killers, and they kill gays, they kill,
they're anybody. Brutal. They're super right-wing, super extremist. Like, they say within the film that, like, the Nazi party does, modern Nazi party doesn't even want anything to do with them.
Ultra right wings don't want anything to do with them. Yeah. Nothing. Like, they're terrible people.
Damn.
And they, during the movie, they live up to that name. And it is some horrific stuff. And it really shows the range that Kevin Smith can build tension.
Yeah.
Because you never really see that. You never really see that in his movies. It's, I would say he didn't stick the landing completely, because I think I'd say this with a pun, he copped out kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I still love the first, you know, it's an hour and 30 minutes, like a hour 15 minutes. Like, the last little bit was kind of like, okay.
Yeah.
It was kind of cheese, but I still enjoyed it.
I think it's a solid horror film that still holds up. Certain concepts within it, with, you know, a lot of social unrest, the way society is now versus the way it was then. Maybe it's even more relevant now. Yeah. You know, but very extreme, man. Really brutal. Like,
yeah,
like the first major kill within the movie stands out to me. Like, I'll never forget it, man. It's brutal. Like, it's not campy at all. There's no fucking comedy. It's a real horror film. You know, we all debated whether or not he could pull off a horror film when it first came out. We were like, oh, I was excited. I personally knew it was going to be good. I knew it was going to be worthwhile, but I was just very curious on how he was going to handle it, you know? And he's proven that he can definitely do other genres.
Yeah.
I just read a quote that said, Red State Blue Balls. Is that kind of how it feels? Like, it just kind of, like, leaves you hanging a little bit?
Yeah, it also really rips on the ATF. You'll figure out if you ever see the movie.
Yeah.
Because they're being watched by the government, and they think they smuggle in firearms. And so the ATF gets involved, and my political stance, those group of people I don't like either, the ATF or, yeah, but, and they really show, like, their villainous, you know, acts as well. Like, nobody's really a good guy in this film. Uh-huh. You don't
root for anyone.
Yeah. You can't root for anybody.
Not even, like, the initial central supposedly protagonist, like, main characters, you know, because they're doing something that's, like, frowned upon, you know, like soliciting prostitution, and, you know, and they're kind of fucked up people. Yeah. Nobody's really there. There's no
good guy
protagonist.
I still love it. I still love that movie.
I haven't seen it in its entirety since it first came out. I'll admit, I fell asleep. I was watching it last night. I only watched the first half, so maybe I'm, like, speaking so favorably because I need to watch what Matt's talking about, how it's a cop out at the end, you know.
Damn.
It still was clever, but it's just like the tension completely grew, and then it severs itself.
Yeah.
I'm just like, oh, peacock.
So, you know? So it is the blue balls.
Yeah, so, yeah, we can, you know, but.
Damn.
Right. So now he's deep inside of his, he's deep within his podcast at this point, 2012, 2013. He's obviously been making TV shows as well. And also, before we continue, he always used to do the he'd do Q&As all the time, and he'd film them and he'd release them. He called him An Evening with Kevin Smith, and he just, that's how much he loved his fans. Like, he just, like, you know, people would ask him fucking questions, and he'd go into our responses. Like, I remember the first Evening with Kevin Smith, it was 4 hours long.
Jesus.
On DVD. I was just like, but I loved every second of it. You hear him talk, you know, and it's ironic that he plays a silent character in most of his movies. But when you get him talking, he doesn't shut up.
Because, and it's nice to hear him talk, you know. There's never a time where it's like, all right, let's move on. You know, it's like everything you hear him say, he's really smart, kind of, you know, soft-spoken, you know. He's just like, he's just kind of, it's pleasant to hear him talk about his own material.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
Or reflect on what's going on within a film as the character.
It's like a true behind-the-scenes stuff, like stuff you wouldn't learn, like, if you just saw it. Like the bonus features, and it was,
and he's super real and down to earth, and just, you know, just cool as shit, nice guy, you know.
So, and now, you know, after all this, he makes another movie with Justin Long. Did you end up watching that one again?
I watched it last night. Yeah,
Tusk.
Yeah,
I haven't seen it in a while. I actually didn't watch it rolling up to the podcast, but I do remember it distinctively. You know, podcaster goes on this interview and gets caught in
Canada.
Yeah.
He has to cross the border into Canada to interview this guy kind of as a joke, but laughing at the guy, not laughing with him, basically, establishing the fact that he's not the best person in the world in the beginning, you know, and already claiming that he might potentially cheat on his girlfriend along the way and this and that. So you don't love the character, you know, but you also don't want to see what happens to him happen to anybody. It's fucking terrifying. Goofy. Dude. It's goofy, but the concept is terrifying.
Yeah.
All right.
And do you think that holds up? After watching it?
I felt the exact same way. I was hoping I would like it more or less. I felt the same way. So not great and not terrible either. He definitely built tension well within the film. You know, the everything leading up to when Justin Long is physically turned into a walrus, you know.
Oh, shit. Yeah, I just saw a fish.
Yeah. So, psychotic guy living kind of off the grid, is a modern serial killer that's killed 23 people, has an array of stories. He's lived the life of 5 men, you know, and he was lost at sea at one point in time and ends up on an island and befriending a walrus that saves his life. And he ends up having to even kill the walrus and eat it. So, like, physically, it did save his life before he got rescued. But now, he hates humanity. He's a complete misanthrope, you know. He's never come across the kindness and the protectiveness of this walrus when he was lost at sea. So he's trying to recreate that in the world. He claims that he's a land lover now. So he's physically performing like plastic surgery procedures with human skin and creating a walrus suit and trying to transform a human being by ripping their tongue out to where they can't speak and actually physically forcing tusks made of their own lower legs into their mouth. It's some human centipede shit is what it is. It's body horror like the Human Centipede, which is goofy. I think those movies are goofy too, but this was so over the top goofy.
Waddling, dude.
Dude, the worst part, it was even fine if what they did was they showed it too much. You know, there could have been glimpses. It didn't have to be in giant lights overhead. There could have been more shadows. You could have shot it more creatively, but I don't think he wanted it to be a horror comedy. I don't think he wanted it to just be a horror film.
Yeah.
The worst thing that ruins the movie for me is when the serial killer, the guy who's doing all this, puts on a walrus suit himself and they have a walrus battle.
Oh my God.
I almost turned the movie off. That was when it became too much for me.
Oh, yeah.
But Johnny Depp even plays a pretty big role. He's a private investigator that's been following. Well, he's like lost his job at this point because he's so off the wall, goofy, crazy. He's been following this serial killer who calls himself Howard Howell all these years. And he knows that he's like right on the verge of catching him when Justin Long's girlfriend and best friend who he podcasts with comes to Canada to try and find him.
Yeah.
But that's another part of the story that makes me realize that I don't think he wanted it to be taken 100% seriously. He wanted to create a horror comedy because Johnny Depp's character is so absurdly over the top and ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, it's I still think it holds up, but you got to go in thinking this is a horror comedy.
Yeah.
But it's also very unsettling up until the point that it becomes comedy. And even after that point, if you really sit there and reflect upon what happened within the film, you realize you're watching one of the most fucked up films ever made.
Yeah.
It makes me sick to my stomach to think about what happens in the movie. It literally makes me sick.
It's like watching The Shunting in the society.
It is so fucked up.
Yeah. Like I said, identity crisis, man. It was like, you know, and maybe it was just like, he just had these ideas. Like, okay, I'm just going to make it. And that's what he did. I know we're going to talk about Yoga Hoosiers for like 2 seconds.
Ugh,
but
not interested.
I didn't see it either. I just saw the previews. I saw a little bit of it. I was just like, I don't know. Just not interested.
It looks so fucking stupid, dude. The CGI looks so bad.
Yeah. So, it's definitely one that I'll probably never see. And then afterwards, this is when, right after Yoga Hoosiers came out, Kevin Smith was filming his comedy sketch or his comedy stand up comedy, and he was going to do 2 shows. And after the first show, he started to feel real sick to his stomach. And he was just laying down, and he was just like, oh, man, I don't know what's going on.
Had previously smoking some marijuana.
Yeah. And then the paramedics came, and they're like, you know, he's super embarrassed about his weight, so he didn't really let him touch him. Like, if you're in the medical field, you have to kind of put leads on your chest to, you know, you have to get to there. So he was very insecure about that. And once the paramedics are like, yeah, we need to go, man. You need to go. Now, and so he canceled the second show. He ended up having a heart attack. You know, if you know what a widowmaker is, that's what he had. And
I heard that in an interview with him that they said that the fact that he had smoked weed prior to the show had like actually calmed him and relaxed him to a point that it actually aided in like in the severity of like the symptoms that like it literally could have saved his life potentially.
Wow.
You know, you can't say for sure, but they think that like the fact that he's like that might have actually helped.
Yeah. That's what I say. You know, I'm a paramedic, and whenever somebody's having a heart attack, I was like, listen, I know this is a big deal, but what you have to do right now is stay calm. There's a heart that's already compromised and you're trying to make it work. You don't want to do that. So just breathe.
Yeah.
That's what I want you to do is just breathe. Focus on your breathing. We'll get there. You're doing fine. You're still up. And then that could be very true.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure anybody who's going through that, you know, he was 47 when he had it, I think.
That's scary, man.
Yeah, it can happen to anybody. But he talked about a lot of how he'd just go with his mom to the grocery store and buy like packs and packs of Oreos and just sugar. And then he completely, as soon as that happened, 100% changed his diet. He went from, I think he weighed almost 300 pounds to now less than 2.
Yeah, he's like the epitome of just a dramatic flip-flop, just a complete lifestyle change.
Yeah. There was a point about his weight with the airlines, American Airlines. They wouldn't let him sit because he was too large.
Damn.
That was a huge topic on like the
They wrote that entertainment. Into the movie, too.
Yeah. Yep.
Into the reboot, they actually wrote that into it when they're trying to fly.
And it's going to be profoundly embarrassing. Like, that's going to suck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure it hurt him quite a bit.
Yeah.
And it did. He definitely talked about it. But after the heart attack, he's just like, he recorded himself as soon as he was better. Excuse me. And said, like, I have to make this movie. And then he started talking about Jay and saw about reboot.
Uh-huh.
And... you know, but he said it was going to take a break first and, you know, what have you. And during all that time, he became a vegan, started hiking a bunch, and he took on a healthy lifestyle. And during all this, I know that his hetero life mate, Jason Mewes, went through his own struggles, you know, like in between, he had a very, very large heroin addiction, pills, everything. And he was sober for like 7 years because of his friend Kevin Smith, was going on tour with him. It's called Jan Sambab Get Old. And that's how he became sober. So he can give him something to do.
So he's still up he's until this day. Sober. He's clean. Yeah.
Yeah. He's got his fake teeth because of his mouth.
Yeah. They look kind of goofy.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie.
Yeah. Like Steve-O teeth.
Yeah. You know? He's got that look Steve-O of a teeth. Previous addict. You can tell. You can see it on his face. You can see it, you know, with the teeth and all
sunken
that.
Sunken in eyes, everything. Yeah. You know? He's, yeah. But he's, I choose that over doing drugs. He'd be dead
for
by
sure.
Now.
Yeah. Yeah.
He'd be dead.
You got to wonder if the drugs kind of contributed to his roles over the years. Like, would we have the same Jay in the story that we did? Yeah. I mean, in retrospect, it'd be better if he just lived a healthy life. But, like, because he was an addict, it probably did contribute to his beloved character, you know?
It's like with Eminem, you know? Like, some people like him better when he was on the drugs.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing.
I was kind of thinking in the reboot that his performance, like, it felt like he was trying too hard. And I felt like that a lot, actually. I felt that, like the whole movie was trying too hard, but him specifically, probably because he's just stone cold sober, you know? There is no, like, nothing to muddle his mindset and, like, and just have it, like, flow naturally, you know? He's just so painfully sober that maybe he was trying a little harder. I don't know.
Dang.
But, you know, now, since we're on this movie, he was the only one in that movie that actually stuck his landing. You know, like that was when it became emotional. He had the most, he had to have the most range out of it. And that was something that I know that was going to happen during the middle. I was like, well, this is going to have to kind of reel itself in. And we're going to have to see an emotional Jay, which you've never seen.
Yeah.
Ever. And just wanted to see how it works. And it was beautifully written. I liked how his character, like, besides all the incredible goofiness of the reboot, I actually, it's my, the movies that I have seen is my least favorite.
I hated it.
Yeah.
I hated it.
Yeah. I like the references that was in it. I really did to all of his movies. It paid homage. He's just making a movie. He wasn't making it for us. He was making it for him.
Exactly.
And that's totally fine. Yeah. And I respect that.
Had an existential crisis, realized he just, all he wanted was to be surrounded by the people he loves and love him again. And that was all there was to it. He just wanted to get everybody together and have fun and pay homage to everything that had happened in all of these years. But I just felt like it was lacking in quality, man. It was his movies.
So much CGI.
It sounds stupid to say it was over the top because his movies always are. It's supposed to be that style, his style of comedy, but it was just too much. It was just trying too hard. It was too over the top. It didn't flow. It just sucked, man. But I don't think he gives a shit. He just wanted to be around the. He literally wrote that into the movie itself, you know, as himself.
Val Kilmer was in that movie, and anybody see Val? Did you see?
He looked rough, dude.
Do you know? There's a documentary coming out with him.
Really?
Val Kilmer's voice is gone.
Oh.
Like, he uses a voice, it's completely gone.
Oh, okay.
His voice, it comes out in 5 days on Amazon Prime. I'm going to let you watch that trailer at the end of this episode.
Okay.
I'll post it on the group. But yeah, Val Kilmer is not doing good.
Oh,
but
wow.
Yeah.
But it was all just fanfare, just trying to please everybody with all the nods to the original films and all the references. And it was very self-indulgent, I think. I don't think it was meant to be a fantastic film. It was just for the fun of it.
Yeah, you exactly. know? And I hope with Clerks 3, he kind of gets back to his roots.
He's got to reel it back in a little bit from that.
I was just like, yeah, you made your movie. We get it. I'm not going to tell him how to make movies or anything, but like you're making movies so you can also entertain us as well. So, and, you know, some of it, most of it is, but as of that kind of switch, it's been rough,
yeah,
you know. So but I still love Kevin Smith. I will continue to watch his films. I won't watch his TV shows because I don't know when he makes them. He's been making Supergirl and a bunch of other these comic book movie shows. I wonder if he'll ever make a comic book movie. He wrote a draft for the Green Hornet and also a Superman reboot. when Nick Cage was gonna be Superman.
Yeah, I heard the rumors about that, but they dissipated really quickly.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, he wrote it.
Oh my god, it'd be so bad. I never heard about that. I'm so glad that didn't happen.
Yeah, the John Peters, one of the producers, was like, hey, can't Superman have any friends in the Fortress of Solitude? He's like, it's called the Fortress of Solitude. And then, you know, it's just, it was, he's like, can he fight a giant tarantula? And John Peters ended up making Wild Wild West. And then he starts referencing that story. And he's just like, all of a fucking sudden, you see a giant tarantula. It's like, look at this piece of shit. I mean, he's made a lot of good decisions in his career. But, you know, that's the even flow of the movie making. You can't always, they can't always be hits, you know. And that goes for just about everyone. I don't like every movie from Martin Scorsese. I don't like every. there are movies I don't like from Martin Scorsese. But, you know, there's movies I don't like from Francis Ford Coppola. There's movies I don't like from Steven Spielberg. You know, I'm just like, there's people that just, you know, it's just the way filmmaking works sometimes, you know. And it's, I always appreciate Kevin Smith. I grew up watching Kevin Smith. He's one of, you know, he's the reason that I want to start, you know, writing. I like the way he just writes them, and I hope to kind of emulate that somehow. And I don't want him to stop making movies, and I hope he doesn't. Hope he lives a lot longer time, you know, because he died. He almost died, and that would have been devastating. You know, because when I found out, it was the day before my birthday when I found out he had a heart attack.
Damn.
So, and I was just like, holy shit, you know. And I was just like, he's fucking fat, bro. I mean, like, he might die. I mean, I didn't cry or nothing, but I was just like, well, I mean, if he did, I probably would have, honestly, but.
Yeah, I'm definitely glad to still have him around.
Yeah.
I'm excited to see. I really hope he does more horror, you know, just coming from that perspective, because I love that the most, you know, and I think he's done a stand-up job so far. Yeah, I mean, obviously, like I said, I have my complaints, but I want to see him do more, you know, other genres, break away from the Buick universe.
I'd like to see him in a Marvel movie, I think, directing a Marvel movie.
That'd be cool.
Yeah.
Kevin Feige wants
to. He fucking loves Star Wars. Yeah. He could get involved with a Star Wars project.
Yeah.
That'd be cool.
So he's very well known in the studio world. Like, he 100% could direct an MCU movie.
I don't think he's taken very seriously. You know, he's respected.
Yeah.
Especially by his peers and friends and people who have worked with him. But I don't think he's taken seriously enough in just in the film community.
Yeah.
And, well, I want to see him do whatever the fuck he wants to do. Like, if he just wants to keep doing Viewisk Universe forever until the day he dies, that's great. I would love to see that too. But I'd like to see him break away from and do other stuff, you know. Yeah.
Quentin Tarantino had private screening of Clerks 2, and he posted it on they have reviews on boxes and stuff like that, and on the box it said, I fucking love this movie. And it's like Quentin Tarantino on it, like, and he talks about it a lot whenever he's asked about it, and he adored the Clerks too.
Yeah.
So he's definitely known within the film world. I've met him once or twice. I've been to a lot of his shows, and I'm gonna continue doing it. And he's definitely a pioneer for me, anyways.
And for independent cinema in general.
Well, man, we knocked that one out of the park, didn't we? I think we talked Kevin Smith quite enough today. No, but what's the next show? What did I say we were talking about? Trilogies, that was it.
Oh. A lot of movies to watch.
Well, you don't have to. I mean, you guys could just roll on.
No matter what, the homework assignment first, right out of the gate, involves three movies minimum. Like, it's three times the amount of homework.
Lord of the Rings is like 8 hours.
You're going to have to watch the theatrical edition, extended edition, and the 4K extended edition.
Okay? Oh, man, that fucking sucks. I got to watch Lord of the Rings again for like the 12th time.
Yeah, right.
Darn.
I have to finish. I started.
Can't wait.
Watching them again.
Yeah. Is there a logical ending point when it comes to trilogies? Is that should be the way things are, or should it just be the cinematic universe.
If you do it right, I think a trilogy makes sense. You know, it's you establish what it is, and if it's a success, then great. Then you move on to the sequel, and you want to outdo yourself. You want to surpass yourself, potentially try to be better with a bigger budget, with more backing, and then the third movie just sums it all up. You know,
it's a
really nice arc. It's a nice setup if you do it right.
And mostly people fucking don't.
And they, almost never do. I can only think of a few. On one hand, I can probably count the successful trilogies.
Yeah. So it's a very tough thing to do, but, you know, that's kind of what we're going to be talking about. Why the success of cinematic universes versus the success of a trilogy. And they're going to kind of battle it out here on the next show, on the Average Joe Movie Show. But before we go, a special shout out to Ragged Cadavers. If you like horror enamel pins and you are collecting them, we got plenty coming from Ragged_Cadavers from Instagram. Drew, what is the newest pin that you have? Actually, you have two more. What was your?
So we have just released our Beetlejuice pin, which is, quite popular so far. We still got plenty left, though, if anybody wants to get their hands on it. It's a 3D pin. It's got multi-dimensions. It's two pins in one. Next pin is going to be from Creepshow, 1982. Haven't even announced it yet.
It is currently in
production, and we should have it in hand in probably about 3 weeks. It's looking good so far. It's going to be a beautiful one. Also, check us out at Spooky Empire. We're going to be attending October 22nd. Through the 24th, it's going to be a joint booth. It's the Average Joe Movie Show podcast booth featuring Ragged Cadavers.
Yeah, and be sure to get a raffle ticket when you come see us, because we're going to be giving away a PS5 and an autographed Nightmare on Elm Street NECA figure. So I'm sure everybody has a preference. But, yeah, can't wait to see you all again a couple weeks from now. You got any announcements there, Shane?
No, I was just I was gonna talk about Ragged Cadavers too. Like I bought a lot of his pins, and they're the nicest pins in my collection. And
fuck yeah,
like they're glow in the dark, and like you got moving parts on these. It's I've never seen pins like this.
Yeah,
so thanks, dude. Check them out.
Yeah, people have been responding well lately. I've been having a bunch of people at work pick them up for other people as gifts. Like the Beetlejuice one, everybody's like, "Oh, my girlfriend wants that one." You know, I'm selling a. Selling them pretty regularly right now. It's going pretty good. You know, it's making me feel like there might be a future for my little endeavor I'm doing here.
Nice.
Well, all right. Well, that's it for the show today. We are the Average Joe Movie Show. I'm Matt Wallace. We got Andrew Brown here. Say goodbye.
Bye, guys.
All right. Shane. Say goodbye.
Bye.
I will say bye for Zach for now. He'll be back on the next show.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. I watched the documentary. Yeah. Take care.